which controls 60% of the world's economy, seeks solutions to crises that threaten not only their own populations, but the lives of all inhabitants of the planet. For this reason, the G7 summit carries great significance for news agencies and scientific circles. Months in advance, experts and journalists propose subjects to draw the attention of policymakers. The events of 2013 were of this same nature, a year in which the G7 summit differed markedly from previous years. Given the circumstances of that time, it would not have been surprising if experts had recommended focusing on climate change, the economic crisis following 2008, or the Syrian war and the rise of Daesh, but that was not the case. For example, one British expert took a different stance. Professor Sally Davis, the UK government's health advisor, released a striking report, a report she considered more important than terrorism or climate change. The subject of her report was antibiotic-resistant bacteria. In a stark warning, Davis declared, "Bacterial resistance to antibiotics is like a ticking time bomb."
I'm a hematologist, but I became chief medical officer in England and senior medical advisor to the UK government in 2010. And early on in my time, I realized that antimicrobial resistance, manifested by drug-resistant infections, was out of hand. And not only was it soaring nationally in the UK and abroad, but we'd got an empty pipeline, so not enough, hardly any new drugs coming through. And there really wasn't much of a focus on it. And I thought that we needed to campaign to try and get people to understand the severity of the problem and then take some action.
She emphasized that in the coming years, even a simple surgery could end in human death. Infections might, as in past centuries, claim the lives of millions and bring all medical treatments to a halt. Davis's remarks were unexpected and shocking. She said this crisis threatens not only her own country, England, but humanity as a whole. A crisis that could become the defining danger of the future world.
Drug-resistant infections are now killing a lot of people. At least 7,000 people worldwide, and that's going to go up to 10 million a year by 2050 if we don't take action. Moreover, as it goes up, more than 28 million people will be driven into abject poverty. So this is a serious issue.
The audience for Davis's warnings were the leaders of the seven industrial nations, countries that could, at the upcoming summit, address this hidden crisis. Yet her remarks contained another startling point. She stressed that, over the years, bacteria had grown resistant to antibiotics, but there was also a new problem. Davis's report revealed that, since 1987, no new antibiotic had been developed. 25 decisive years in which bacteria, by strengthening their defenses, managed to push the planet to the brink of crisis. This crisis raised new questions for world leaders and ordinary people alike. Were Davis's words true? What was behind the halt in antibiotic production? And who could possibly prevent this looming catastrophe? The answers to these urgent questions lay not in the headlines, but in the history of antibiotics, a history full of strange events.
Centers for Disease Control warning hospitals nationwide about a growing number of superbugs. There's a new deadly superbug spreading in hospitals across America.
Half of all the patients who get it die.
The nightmare bacteria are now completely untreatable.
When British media covered Davis's proposal to the G7, another event took place in London. In the archives of the British Library, a handwritten manuscript from the 10th century had caught the attention of experts. The book Bald's Leech Book contained a strange medical recipe, a traditional remedy for fighting infections. Experts considered this medieval text a kind of antibiotic, contrary to the claims of critics who restricted antibiotics to only the modern era. This book, along with other historical evidence, showed that the struggle against infections was an ancient aspiration as old as human history itself. The first attempts to combat infections began with the peoples of ancient Egypt and Greece. These civilizations had discovered through experience that molds and certain plants could help destroy infections. Their methods continued to be used in later centuries, and in fact, the writing of that medieval manuscript was influenced by these practices. The methods kept only a small number of patients alive. Regardless of the outcome, the fight against infections persisted after the Middle Ages and into the 20th century, a century that brought medicine into a new phase. During World War I, the greatest concern of doctors was reducing the casualties among soldiers. They tried every possible way to save more lives, but with little success. Bacteria quickly infected soldiers' wounds, and those wounds became the main cause of death. Doctors such as Alexander Fleming, the Scottish physician, sought a solution to this problem in the years after the war. For a decade, his experiments yielded no results, until in September 1928, something unexpected happened. He accidentally discovered that the fungus Penicillium had antibacterial properties. This discovery, soon known as penicillin, was considered the first of the antibiotics, a substance capable of destroying harmful bacteria in animals. But after this discovery, an important question arose among Fleming's colleagues. Could this drug also work in the human body? Over the next two decades, the answer to Fleming's crucial question was found. Extensive research on his results led to the development of antibiotics. These substances, originally natural in origin, were now being produced in laboratories to save the lives of both animals and humans. The creation of drugs such as neomycin, kanamycin, and nystatin was the outcome of these efforts that further increased the fame of antibiotics. Yet, a serious problem remained. Antibiotics could only save millions of lives if they were produced on a large scale. The greatest challenge facing medicine was the mass production of antibiotics, a challenge that coincided with an unexpected and bitter event, World War II. When Hitler spread the flames of war across Europe, countless soldiers were sent to the front. Many were transferred to field hospitals, where doctors once again relived the bitter memories of the First World War. The infected wounds of thousands of soldiers had to be treated, not only to save their lives, but because politicians needed every single one of them to secure victory in the war. The only thing that could meet this need was antibiotics, and the only entities capable of producing them in vast quantities were governments. The warring states pressured pharmaceutical companies, and the process of antibiotic production began. The process, by keeping human forces alive, was able to change the course of the war.
Allied casualties in Normandy receive the most expert medical care science can provide. Two modern treatments, penicillin and blood transfusion, have cheated death in thousands of cases. Gangrene, from which millions have perished in past wars, has been conquered by the miracle of penicillin. Thousands of men, thanks to penicillin, will come home to their thankful families. The whole world of peace to come will reap the benefits of this great wartime medical discovery. Science has won another victory over death.
By the final year of World War II, antibiotics were produced only for soldiers. But after Germany's defeat, everything changed. Doctors had managed to demonstrate the importance of antibiotics to politicians who, armed with the successful experience of war, returned to rebuild the cities. What mattered most in this reconstruction was neither money nor military power. Governments were still focused on keeping their human resources alive. A strange idea emerged for the new post-war era: capitalism. Capitalism encouraged greater production and consumption, and economists knew that to achieve this, they needed, above all, large numbers of healthy people who could both work in factories and buy the products those factories produced. In past centuries, early deaths and widespread diseases had been humanity's nightmare. Even 20th century people had endured the deadly Spanish flu. The illnesses limited global population growth. For this reason, antibiotics became capitalism's favorite drug. Within a short time, their use created a miracle in public health. Human lifespan increased, minor and major infections were no longer fatal, and most importantly, dangerous surgeries became possible. Antibiotics were the key to successful organ transplants and complex operations, saving lives in yet another way. Population growth owed itself to antibiotics, while capitalism owed its expansion to the increase in labor and consumption. The global economy quickly grew through this mechanism, and the fame of antibiotics even entered popular culture. Now, every patient, regardless of education level, expects a doctor to prescribe antibiotics, so it's not surprising that, according to annual statistics, 2.5 billion people worldwide consume them, a seemingly healing drug whose use is not only widespread directly, but also hidden in certain cases. Billions may believe they do not take antibiotics, but critics argue this is a mistaken assumption. Antibiotics hold secrets that most people remain unaware of. the mid-20th century, just before antibiotics were mass-produced for humans, another development occurred. Researchers announced that this drug could first and foremost transform food production and human food security. Until then, the production of food products was not subject to specific health regulations, and in some countries, traditional methods of production meant that bacteria entered the human body along with food. The discovery of antibiotics changed this process, and researchers proposed their use in the livestock and poultry industry. The industry for years had struggled with widespread animal deaths and diseases, problems that limited meat production and kept its price high. But antibiotics worked like a miracle. This substance could help livestock farmers in three ways. First, by preventing disease. Second, by treating sick animals. And third, and most importantly, by astonishingly accelerating the growth rate of animals. This was welcome news for the livestock industry.
The power to promote growth. Note the weight of a chicken raised for 8 weeks on a regular feed. Now another chicken nourished for the same period on regular feed plus paramycin. A 15% increase in growth.
Now it was possible to imagine mass, fast and cheap meat production, and to raise meat consumption even among the poor. This was the beginning of industrial livestock farming, which started with the prescription of antibiotics. Yet after a few years, strange events occurred. The events could not be hidden from the public eye. Animals looked cheerful only on product packaging, while the real conditions were far different from the advertising images. Soon, painful pictures from the industrial farms reached the public. The miserable conditions of reproduction were only part of the story. Exploitation, poor living environments, and finally, brutal methods of slaughter were exactly what had been foreseen. Keeping chickens in cramped, dark spaces was as disturbing as watching the treatment of sheep during shearing. The crowding of fish in oxygen-deprived pools could be as troubling as the abuse of cattle. These images were the result of one development: mass meat production made possible by antibiotics. But these images were not the only problem. Critics pointed to the livestock industry as the source of a new crisis. Statistics show that 80% of antibiotics produced in the United States are consumed by the livestock sector. In Europe, the figure is about 50%. These numbers are themselves the crisis, one that also negatively affects animals in another way. Critics argue that the excessive use of antibiotics in livestock farming has brought the world to the brink of disaster. Over the past decades, this industry, in pursuit of greater profit, has used enormous amounts of the drug, creating a situation that has now led to the emergence of microbes and bacteria resistant to antibiotics. Findings suggest that animals' bodies have become so saturated with antibiotics that they can no longer fight off new bacteria. The growth of resistant bacteria in the appalling conditions of industrial farms creates the central crisis. the widespread outbreak of bacteria among animals and their mass deaths. A looming catastrophe that, it is said, has another hidden dimension. A dangerous dimension that threatens not only animals, but humans as well.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In September this year, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced his government's plans to introduce mandatory digital ID for all British citizens by 2029. The announcement sparked fury across the full spectrum of the British political landscape, uniting forces who would otherwise disagree on pretty much everything else. The digital ID's plans have led to continuous protests, with thousands braving wintry weather conditions in London on Saturday to express their opposition to the plans.
We're here to protest digital ID. We're also here to make the point to people that they're already being tracked, they're already being surveilled and controlled by systems beyond their knowledge or control. And this is just an extra step. And this is almost a way for the government to act like we're giving our consent for them to track us. But they're doing it anyway.
Today,
the main justification given by Starmer for the rollout of digital IDs is to help the government's crackdown on illegal migration, leading to suspicions that the so-called migrant crisis was allowed to develop to then justify these types of draconian measures in response.
A massive fear that many Brits have is that the digital ID plans, in combination with a rumoured ban on the use of cash in the future, portends the creation of a dystopian AI-powered control grid where every move you make is subject to surveillance and censorship by the state in real time.
Freedom!
These protesters believe that enough of the country is opposed to the digital ID rollout, but that for mass non-compliance to become a realistic prospect, unity across the political spectrum is a must.
Anybody organising anything can be controlled by this. So we want everyone to unite in common cause. As we say in our leaflet here, Palestine and freedom fighters, indeed everyone, unite in common cause.
The British state has long wanted to introduce digital IDs, going as far back as when Tony Blair floated the prospect when he was Prime Minister in the 2000s. But with mass opposition already forming and one of the most unpopular governments in recent history at the helm, opponents are quietly confident in their chances of defeating the entire idea altogether. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice. Either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near-final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
You
Yemen's health minister, Ali Shayban, paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The latest U.S. jobs reports paints a bleak portrait of the American economy under President Donald Trump. Newly released data showed the unemployment rate climbed to 4.4% in September, its highest level since October 2021, signaling a labor market losing momentum. Industries once considered pillars of the American economy are faltering. Transportation and warehousing shed more than 25,000 jobs, while manufacturing lost another 6,000 positions. The report itself was delayed for weeks due to the government shutdown, a disruption triggered by political brinkmanship in Washington. Its release now lands alongside troubling inflation data. Manual inflation in September reached its highest reading since January, confirming that prices are accelerating at their fastest pace of the year. Economists point to one major culprit behind rising costs: Trump's aggressive and increasingly erratic tariff regime. Since returning to office, he has slapped steep import taxes on goods from dozens of countries, including long-standing allies. Instead of reviving American industry, the tariffs have pushed production costs upward and left consumers footing the bill. Trump had promised Americans that prices would fall on day one of his presidency. Instead, a clear majority now report that their expenses have surged. Despite Trump's repeated insistence that there is virtually no inflation, a new Harris poll shows Americans continuing to feel financial strain and growing more pessimistic about the economic direction of the country. The data underscore their frustration. The typical American household now spends $208 more dollars every month just to purchase the same basket of goods and services as a year earlier, and more than $1,000 more per month compared with early 2021 when the nation was emerging from the pandemic. Now, many analysts believe that if the Trump administration continues doubling down on these policies, the financial pressure will only spread. Higher prices, fewer job opportunities, and a shrinking margin of stability for millions of households already stretched thin.
Iran Geo 2025 opening its doors to the public.
The event that has rapidly become the country's main platform for showcasing advances in mapping, satellite imaging, GIS systems, and spatial data technologies. This year, for the first time, the Armed Forces Geographical Organization and the National Mapping Organization of Iran have joined hands to bring the entire geospatial ecosystem under one roof.
When governance is founded on information and knowledge, geospatial data becomes a powerful tool. Exhibitions like Iran Geo help us shape sound strategies and prevent future crises. Accurate spatial data reduces imbalances and supports smarter long-term planning. These technologies let us look ahead, not just react to problems, and that makes a lasting contribution to the country.
Knowledge-based firms filling several halls demonstrating AI-driven mapping engines, cloud-based GIS, drone surveying systems, and real-time spatial analytics.
This is one of the biggest cartography and geospatial technology events, not just in Iran, but in the region. The large number of foreign participants here shows its importance. Mapping from space, which is our area of specialization, is among the key joint projects. Many of the challenges humanity faces, from climate change and water scarcity to global warming and resource management, go beyond any single country. Our mapping strategies are now accurate to within 1 meter.
The Armed Forces Geographical Organization explaining how it delivered uninterrupted spatial support during the recent 12-day Israeli aggression.
Our goal is for government leaders to recognize and apply Iran's geospatial achievements in national planning. Many of today's challenges are rooted in geography, and spatial technologies help reduce inefficiencies and guide smarter decisions. These tools enable precise identification of issues, prevent overlap, and advance sustainable development.
Across the venue, visitors exploring how geospatial intelligence has become essential for everything from emergency response to infrastructure design. Over 100 foreign visitors, including BRICS and ECO military attachés, also visiting the venue.
I think it's very good that your country has an exhibition on the techniques and the new developments, and it's always good for a country to have a good geographical image of that country, especially at the moment climate problems with the water. So it's always good to know what your country looks like.
Over 30 companies and 5 major national organizations are exhibiting their full portfolios this year. Every journey starts with a map, and the Iran Geo International Exhibition serves as a platform that brings together technology, governance, and the science of cartography to chart the nation's path forward. Gisum Shahmari, Tehran.
The recent launch of a Muslim association aspiring to be registered as a political party has caused an uproar in Italy. The association, named MURO 27, the acronym for Muslims for Rome, aims to participate in the 2027 mayoral elections in the Italian capital, Rome. Following the announcement of the new association, several Italian media close to Italy's ruling right coalition and some anti-immigrant League party members have slammed the initiative as a threat to Italy's liberal institutions, a project that, quote, aims to plant the crescent flag on Rome's Capitol Hill.
This initiative has been immediately exploited by some anti-immigrant, anti-Islam parties for political gain. Having said that, the initiators of this association should have involved the whole of the Muslim community.
I am of the idea that such initiatives are welcomed when they are in the public interest. Many Italians are very wary of traditional politics, but I am afraid they are not ready to support a Muslim candidate, as recently happened in New York.
The MURO 27 Association has been funded by a group of Muslims led by Francesco Thieri, an Italian engineer who converted to Islam about 20 years ago when he added to his name that of Abd al-Haq, one of the names of God in the Quran. Thieri already ran as a candidate in Rome's 2021 local elections. The Italian capital is home to about 120,000 Muslims, 40,000 of whom are Italian citizens. Islam is not formally recognized as a religion in Italy, despite 1.5 million Muslims live in the country. Furthermore, the organizations representing Muslims are also not legally recognized by the Italian state, albeit Muslims have the constitutional right to practice their religion.
To this day, the issue of the Muslims in Italy has been solely tackled with security policies, overlooking the political, social, and cultural dimensions of our religion. As for the new association, it's not clear yet, in my view, what the nature and the goals of this initiative are.
Strangely enough, Italy already has a Muslim mayor, but no controversy has been raised about his election. It is Moreno Marzetti, an Italian convert who also is a member of the anti-Islam, anti-immigrant League party. He was elected as mayor of Italy's northern town of Malo in 2020. Max Civili, Press TV, Rome.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Journey into the unknown, from West Asia to Turkey, to the Greek islands. Hoping to reach Europe illegally, it is considered one of the stories of illegal immigration faced by many refugees and migrants. This journey often starts from West Asia to the Turkish coast of Izmir, which is a departure point for many people trying to reach Europe, especially across the Aegean Sea, in an attempt to reach the Greek islands. Young Palestinian from Gaza. His story is part of the tragedy lived by the people of Gaza. It reflects the level of despair felt by these young men, despite their attachment to their land and their right to it. However, some see that seeking refuge in Europe is a temporary solution to financially support their families in Gaza and help them endure. Amir risks his life on an illegal journey, hoping to return one day to his occupied homeland under better conditions than today.
I traveled to help my family because of the recent war on Gaza. We lost our lands and our home, and my father and my fiancé were martyred. I traveled to support them, but after everything I witnessed here and the illness we suffered, we gained nothing. We'll return to Gaza after what I have seen here. I will take the residency and go back to Gaza because it is my homeland and I will never abandon it. I will not leave it to the Israelis.
Gaza Strip has been under siege for years, and now it is experiencing genocide, forcing people to leave their land, but they refuse to do so and cling to their land despite the deteriorating economic situation. increasing unemployment rates, and lack of educational and professional opportunities. The residents also suffer from a severe shortage of basic resources such as electricity and water, in addition to the continuous destruction of infrastructure due to armed conflicts and ongoing wars. The people of Gaza face enormous challenges in building their future within the Strip and need support to continue resisting.
I traveled from Gaza alone on a visa to Turkey, then from there to Egypt, and later back to Turkey. I got in touch with a smuggler there, and we set off across the sea 8 times. We saw death with our own eyes until we reached Greece, hoping to live with dignity, but we regretted arriving there. No one understands the suffering of traveling by boat except those who have gone through it. No matter how much I describe it, no one will feel what we went through. Many died at sea because of the Greek Coast Guard, who would shoot at us, take our phones and money, and send us back to the sea mercilessly.
The psychological distress that we see is really high. You have people crying, people shaking, people decompensating as well sometimes. And again, it's always linked to the fear of violence, the fear of being pushed back, the fear of being exposed again to not knowing what will happen, and most often to violence. So there is really those two components in this activity, the medical care, but as well the psychological care.
Israeli colonization of Palestine is the problem of West Asia. But the United States and the European Union have provided significant political, military, and financial support to Israel for decades. This support has contributed to solidifying Israel's military superiority and the continuation of its occupation of Palestinian territories. The United States, in particular, is considered Israel's biggest ally, providing billions of dollars annually in military aid and repeatedly using the veto power in the UN Security Council to prevent resolutions condemning Israeli policies. The European Union presents a more balanced stance on the surface, but practically it also supports Israel through trade agreements and strong diplomatic relations, with timid positions on the ongoing violations of Palestinian rights. Many believe that this support encourages Israel to continue its policies of occupation, settlement, and blockade, without fear of international accountability.
Very interestingly, and actually it shows how what's happening in Greece in terms of migration is linked to the broader picture and what happened outside. People from Gaza were actually one of, or the first community of people arriving in Greece before the 7th of October. People arrive in Europe, in Greece, indeed with a lot of traumatic experience. A lot of violence happened to them from country of origin to the transit country to sometimes as well when just crossing the sea from Turkey to Greece. We provide psychological care. We have a few psychologists, and they either provide group session but also individual session, trying to relieve the suffering of those invisible wounds.
Many humanitarian organizations provide support to migrants on these islands, but the problem persists as it needs radical solutions at the level of European countries and international cooperation. The most important of these solutions is addressing the root causes of migration and developing comprehensive migration policies. The European Union has not provided significant support to Greece to help it face the refugee and migrant crisis that has flooded its lands in recent years.
Our team provides emergency medical assistance to people as they arrive on the shore of the island.
We do this in close collaboration with authorities. There is a public information that notifies at the same time all authorities and all relevant actors that a group of people has landed and is in need of medical care. So then, based on our capacity, we deploy an emergency medical team to go and provide medical and psychological first aid.
The illegal immigration journey taken by Amir and others is not just an escape from a miserable reality, but also a search for solutions to earn money and support their families back home. Even if it is fraught with risks, it is, for them, a temporary solution until their situations improve in their countries. However, they say the only solution to the refugee problem is the end of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and the establishment of peace in West Asia, which requires global international will and UN resolutions.
It is true that asylum is accepted for Palestinians, but the authorities do not cooperate with us at all. We do not enjoy any human rights inside the detention centers, where we suffer from harsh living conditions and widespread diseases with no real medical care. When I went to the hospital 5 times, I only received painkillers without a clear diagnosis of my condition. Life inside the camp is very difficult and inhuman.
The Mediterranean region is considered one of the main routes used by illegal migrants to reach Europe. Boats depart from Turkey and North African countries, such as Libya, Tunisia, and Morocco, heading toward the coasts of Italy, Spain, and Greece. This maritime route is fraught with danger, as thousands of migrants lose their lives at sea each year due to poor travel conditions and overcrowded boats. Political instability in some North African countries, like Libya, exacerbates the issue, as these nations serve as major departure points for migrants. On the other hand, Turkey is used as a gateway for illegal migrants crossing into Greece via the Aegean Sea. Despite agreements between the European Union and Turkey aimed at curbing the flow of migrants, thousands still manage to sneak into Europe through the Turkish-Greek border. These migrants do not stop in Greece, but continue along land routes through Bulgaria and the Balkans, eventually reaching Austria and Germany, where they seek asylum or economic opportunities. Amir met with traffickers and was promised an arrangement for his journey across the sea. These traffickers offer their services for large sums of money, and migrants are often in desperate situations, forcing them to accept the risks that could cost them their lives. The traffickers promise to get them to Europe, but in reality, they cannot guarantee the safety of the journey. After leaving Gaza, Amir set off on a maritime journey aboard a small boat, crammed with dozens of other migrants. The journey across the sea was fraught with dangers: rough waves, high heat, and harsh conditions on board the boat, all of which were unbearable challenges. Amir and his fellow travelers were on the brink of drowning as the boat had technical problems, and there was a shortage of food and water in addition to encounters with the Coast Guard.
I have many friends in Turkey, and we exchange information about the smugglers. There are areas like Izmir and Bodrum that are full of smugglers. The problem is that choosing the wrong smuggler could mean losing money or being deceived. There are different types of trips, with prices ranging from 1,500 to 4,000 euros. The fast boat is the best, as it takes only 10 minutes to reach the island, unlike the regular boats, which take hours and are more dangerous.
So the living condition in the camp is contributing to the prevalence and the spread of preventable disease, including skin disease, respiratory infection, but also gastrointestinal illness that will mainly impact the most vulnerable, including the children. We are also seeing pregnant women who are in need of emergency medical care. The living condition also contribute to anxiety, stress, and depression. That's why MSF is providing services, primary health care, sexual and reproductive health, mental health support, but also legal and social services to assist asylum seekers and refugees in Samos. Of course, when you talk about a population that is contained in camps where living conditions are precarious, you can only imagine how it exacerbates actually the risk for ill health. So you talked about the winter, for example, on Samos this year, the blankets, although it's a regular need, every year we need blankets when it gets cold, and it took a couple of months actually for people to receive blankets. So then usually what we see is a spike in respiratory infections. It's really concerning as well, because in those camps you have a number of more vulnerable population. There's a very high number of children, pregnant women or elderly, and of course they're more at risk of cold weather or in general climate conditions. And then in summertime you have the risk of dehydration, which is also having an impact on the health.
Migrants rely on traffickers who organize their journeys illegally on rickety boats crowded with passengers. These trips are often dangerous because the small boats may not withstand the harsh marine conditions or the large number of passengers. There have been many incidents in which victims have drowned or been injured due to the difficult weather conditions. During the journey, migrants face a major threat from the Greek Coast Guard, who try to intercept the illegally migrating boats. Reports speak of attempts to prevent them from reaching Greek shores, often through imposing legal penalties on the traffickers or returning migrants to Turkey. The problem of illegal migration to Europe through Greece has garnered widespread attention from global news agencies due to its danger and impact on both European countries and the migrants themselves. Greece is one of the main gateways for illegal migrants from the Middle East and North Africa who are trying to reach Europe by sea or through the land border with Turkey. These news agencies also discuss European policies regarding migration, the conflicts between countries like Greece and Turkey over migrant crossings, and the associated humanitarian challenges.
The realities on the ground. On one hand, you have narrative explaining that, of course, migration policies need to be implemented in compliance with human rights or legal frameworks. But the realities on the ground is that you see that the dysfunctioning of the system, whether it's the provision of assistance and services to the people inside the camp, whether it's the functionality of the asylum services. There is delay in the appointment, there is delay in the interviews, you have a lack of interpretation, lawyers are not being paid, which means that some interviews cannot take place. You have again blankets being delayed. So it's really a disconnection between the overall narrative and also the amount of funding that is providing, and then what is actually happening on the ground.
Illegal migration from the Middle East to Europe is one of the main results of armed conflicts, prolonged occupations, and political and economic instability. Some of the key causes of these phenomena include the ongoing Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and the resulting humanitarian and social crises, with the only solution being the end of the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the achievement of a just and comprehensive peace in West Asia.
There is no work in Gaza. We work all day just to be able to buy the simplest necessities, and even housing has become very expensive.
For this reason, we risk leaving Gaza, hoping to provide a decent life for our families.
Detention centers on the Greek island of Samos are among the places that